Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here for WPR News. Here in Wisconsin, we had a very wet spring. We're in the middle of a very dry fall, and so we'll take a look at how it all has affected our gardens, especially with insects and disease. Couple of guests for you. My old friends Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson. Brian Huddleston is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Brian, good to have you back. Oh, we got a microphone. You're muted there,
sorry,
Brian.
Sorry about that. I forgot to turn my microphone on. Thanks, Larry. Thanks for having me on the show today.
Oh, man. Lisa Johnson, our guest as well, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Lisa, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
As we talk with Brian and Lisa, I hope you'll join in. We'll talk with them about this year's gardening season and, of course, take your gardening questions. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send an email to talk@wpr.org. Brian, I want to start with you because we had so many questions about lilacs this year. What's causing all the problems?
Most of what I've been seeing on lilacs is a foliar disease called Septoria leaf spot. And for many of your listeners who have listened to you over the years, we've talked about Septoria leaf spot on tomatoes. And this is a related disease. There are lots of Septoria fungi out in the environment, and there is one that goes to lilacs, and it causes a lot of spotting on the leaves, and eventually those leaves can entirely turn brown, and then they'll either stay on or drop off of the shrubs. Oftentimes the defoliation is from the bottom towards the tops of the shrubs, and it's just been a wonderful year for that disease this year. From my perspective as a plant pathologist, as one of my colleagues says, I have been giddy this year because of all the diseases I've been seeing. And that's quite true because we had a very dry summer last year. And so having some wetness this year really made the diseases pop out. And the Septoria disease, when I go at the end of the year to put together my top 10 diseases of the year, it's going to be in the top 10. It may be pretty close to number one.
Yeah, it looks bad, but should we worry about losing our lilacs?
Really not. It's a quote-unquote cosmetic disease. It does make the shrubs look really bad, but from a lethality sort of standpoint, it's not a lethal disease. And quite frankly, if you go out to your shrubs right now, even those that have dropped the leaves, if you look on the branches, you'll probably see nice fat buds for next year's leaves. And that's an indication that the shrubs are fine. You may see some reduction in blossoming because of the early leaf loss. That'll reduce that. But overall, unless you get defoliation year after year after year, it's not going to cause a lot of serious issues. And we had a round of this back pre-COVID, probably 2017, 18, 19. Or maybe 18, 19, and 20 were pretty good years for this disease. And then it got drier and it didn't show up for several years.
Yeah. Lisa, maybe you could give us an overview of what this year's growing season was like.
A roller coaster, maybe, would be the best analogy. We were so wet in the spring and we couldn't get out into the garden, and we had problems with root rot, and we had, is it ever going to dry out issues? And then it did, and oh my gosh, it did. And so we had, just like the climate change experts have predicted, we have these situations where we have big dumps of rain with, several weeks in between of very dry weather. And of course, as extension folks, we're always advocating for an inch of rain a week. I just gave a climate talk and gardening talk last night, so all this is pretty fresh, where I was talking about we may end up having about an average amount of rainfall for the season, but because of the way it was distributed, for us as gardeners, it's a problem.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And down the road, what do you do? I mean, do we have to look to different kind of plants depending on, the plants and so forth?
Yeah. So in this talk that I give, different, just for Wisconsin.
Sure.
Different areas of the state are impacted differently. Overall, we're seeing that we're getting warmer and wetter winters and springs, and you know, drier falls, extended falls, drier summers. But it's not distributed equally through the state. So depending on where you are, you may be seeing flooding more often, or you may be seeing droughts more often. So depending on where you are, yeah, there are strategies that you can use based on those trends. You know, whether it's mulching and drip irrigation, if you're being drier, or raised beds or berms, if you're having more flood issues, and certainly plant selection.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you can join in with your questions. The number's 800-642-1234, or you can send an email, and I think our experts have access to our emails, are able to see photos that you might send as well. So, Carlene in Oregon, we'll give you a chance to start off here. Hi, Carlene.
Hi there. I'm calling with a question about splitting perennials. My perennials exploded this spring, and the warm weather really, you know, continued that trend. I watered some, but now I usually split in the fall, but I'm afraid they're really stressed now, and without watering them a lot, that I might lose quite a few of them. So I'm wondering about that. And then also I have a Heliopsis that for the second year in a row have had a red aphid infestation that's really impacted their flowering. The plants still are living fine, but their flowers are really tiny, and I can't cut any of them. So two questions.
Okay. So we've got water.
We do. Okay, so for splitting perennials, I think it's based on what type of perennial you're looking at splitting. If it's something like ornamental grasses or hostas or daylilies, those are pretty resilient plants. And I think you could probably split those quite easily without worry. If it's something that should be split this time of year anyway, like Siberian or German bearded iris, I wouldn't worry about that. If it is something that is more delicate or marginally hardy, then maybe you want to hold off on that. Now, if you have been watering, you know, throughout the summer, stress is obviously going to be less, but of course we all try and you know, not use resources that we don't need to use. So I'm certainly not I'm not judging you if you haven't watered them a lot either, because I totally get that. So I think based on whatever it is that you want to divide, kind of use that plant vigor as a guide. Now for the aphids, I think those are oleander aphids, the red ones. On some plants, they don't seem to, especially like the natives, it doesn't seem to hurt them too much. But I know what you mean. They do like to hang out on and feed on flower buds. So that certainly can, you know, affect. You can get distorted flowers and so on. And I'm sure Brian will tell us that aphids can carry various phytoplasmas and viruses. Or is it more viruses?
Yeah, more viruses. Phytoplasmas tend to be leafhopper transmitted, but I'd worry a little bit. I don't know about this specific aphid, but aphids in general tend to carry cucumber mosaic virus, which can be problematic.
All right.
Yeah. So I guess, I do see those on native plants a lot. You can certainly use, you know, a good strong spray of water, if you feel that you need to, control them. Neem oil can be very effective on, aphids. I know that I have seen, some materials about those aphids on natives. So I will try and find that for you.
Okay. Carlene, thanks, and stay listening. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Kristen emailed, and I don't know if you saw the email photo of her mother's beans, but yeah, not the pods themselves. They're kind of...
Very spotted, yellow spots, and then you turn the leaves over, and you've got these brown kind of bumps on the bottom surface of the leaf. Yeah, I was kind of excited to see those photos because I haven't seen this disease for a while. It's a rust disease. So the rusts are a very large group of fungal disease-causing organisms. And there's one particular genus called Euromyces, which tends to cause problems on different types of beans. So snap beans and dry beans and also lima beans. It can go to other types of beans as well. And the plants were quite heavily infected. It was a severe case, and that can cause eventual leaf loss. I would expect eventually you might see some spotting on the pods as well. Recommendations for control, basically rotating away from bean production in the area for about 2 years. I'd be very careful about removing those infected plants and getting them out of the garden. And the ways I would recommend getting rid of those would be primarily you could burn the material if you have that option. You could actually deep bury it if you just kind of plow it under and bury that leaf tissue. That would be a way of getting rid of it for a while. You have to be a little bit careful that if you turn that soil again within that kind of two-year period, you might bring up some of the spores back. That fungus is going to survive in old plant debris. Once that debris has kind of rotted away, then the pathogen isn't going to survive particularly well. You do run the risk, though, of the spores blowing in again from another area. That can happen as well. And then don't plant bean crops in that area for the kind of that two-year period. And then be careful with watering. Part of what you're probably dealing with is the fact that we did have a lot of rain early on, and that gets the leaves wet. And these sorts of fungi do better. They infect better when the leaves are wet for an extended period of time. So in a more normal year where we have a little less rain all at once, then if you have to water from below, so a soaker hose, or if you're using a watering can, make sure you don't get that moisture on the leaves.
And when you say don't plant in that area, how far away? I mean, some people...
Well, yeah, if you get rid of the debris and kind of do some tillage to kind of bury anything that's left, you could potentially, it's always hard to say. Farther is better. I can't give an exact distance because, again, some of these spores can blow for extended distances. So it's hard to give a hard and fast, distance for these sorts of things. But farther is better. But again, like I said, even if you do all of this, you always run the risk of spores blowing in from another area. Mm-hmm. And rust spores are notorious for being blown long distances. So you may do everything in your yard to take care of the disease, but it could be a neighbor has a problem and isn't taking care of it, and then spores are going to come in from your neighbor.
Lee in Green Bay has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Lee.
Yeah, hi. Last night I picked up a large pail of horse chestnuts from the tree that's in our yard, and I'd like to know how I can maybe plant them next spring. Do I have to winter them?
That Brian and I are both looking at each other. This is kind of
outside
of
my wheelhouse, unfortunately.
Yeah, a little out of mine as well. I do have a resource I can check. Michael Durr has this great book on woody plant propagation, which, everything from taking cuttings to using the seeds off of milkweed cones, and I'm sure there's a piece on horse chestnuts, and I can look that up. But unfortunately, I don't have that information right.
Off the top of the head.
Yeah.
Okay. It makes sense that they might need an overwintering period or a cold period, but for sure. But we'll look into it, Lee. So stay listening. We'll see what we can come up with there, because that question hasn't come up on the show before, in my memory at least, and so I don't know of anyone else who's had comments on that on the show. Well, we'll get some information for you before the show is over. Becky in Sturgeon Bay, we'll turn to you. Hi, Becky.
Hi. So my question is, if I want to plant trees, at the time, close to the time of dormancy, one, how long can I wait around here? And two, how much do they have to be watered before the ground freezes?
I'm sorry, where did you say you're located?
Sturgeon Bay.
Oh, okay. So you're up there a ways. I guess, here in the Madison area, we're going to start going like in the next couple of days down into the 50s for highs and 30s overnight. So I'd say you're kind of pushing it at this point. I don't know what your temperatures have been like recently, but I would say that if you want to do it, make sure that they're trees that are really hardy for your area. There are some trees that should not be planted in fall, such as birch, any kind of evergreens, anything that's marginally hardy. And I would add any plants like Japanese katsura tree, for example, that need a lot of water. The problem with planting really late is that the tree is not going to get too established at all, and you do run the risk when we have, freeze-thaw events, and if it happens to be a particularly cold winter, that the tree might not survive very well. That being said, if you have something like, a maple that's really hardy in your area, if you got it in this weekend, mm-hmm. you probably would be okay. I would still make sure that you're watering, and you're in Sturgeon Bay, so you have really good drainage. I'd be making sure that you're watering very well, maybe 2 inches of water a week. The other way to measure that, because sometimes people go, well, what the heck does that mean, 1 inch of water a week? If you look at the caliper or girth of the trunk, the diameter, and you measure that at about 4.5 feet up from the base, from where the root flare is, and you get that amount. If you give the tree 10 gallons of water per caliper inch, that will more or less work out to that 1 inch. And it's really easy to do if you get yourself a 5-gallon bucket, drill some holes in it, and let the water, slowly drain out. And then you move the bucket around the perimeter of the root zone. And that can work really well. But I would say you're pushing it a little bit right now.
Yeah, but if you've got it, put it in the ground.
Yeah, if you've already got the tree, for goodness sakes, do put it in the ground.
Yeah.
But if it's something that's on sale and you're kind of contemplating, and I know I do the same thing, just keep the risks in mind.
There are lots of sales going on right now on on trees, 50-75% off in some situations.
Yep.
So you want to take a chance. Don't wait.
Yeah.
Don't wait to act. And water right up until freeze, I would think.
Yep, exactly.
Let's go to Dave in Appleton next. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So, I've got a question on growing potatoes. I bury my compost, and for some reason, it must have been buried just a few inches deep, there were potatoes, and there are pieces of potatoes from dinner or whatever, and they bumper crop this year. I mean, I had 2 plants that had a 5-gallon bucket full of potatoes. Is it okay to put in potatoes now a few inches under the soil. I always thought in the winter they would freeze, turn to mush. But can I put them in now and get that kind of crop next year?
I think your idea that they're going to freeze and turn to mush is probably more realistic. While compost piles do stay warmer than, you know, surrounding areas if they've been properly, you know, hot composted, I wouldn't risk it over winter. I have to say, though, that I'm jealous. I planted potatoes myself in my raised bed this year, and not only did I not get a good yield, but they were scabby. And so, Brian, I read your fact sheet and I was like, oh.
I was going to ask you, Brian, about the potatoes and what concerns growers have had with potatoes.
I would have real serious concerns from as a plant pathologist with volunteer potatoes coming up and keeping those around, because there's always the potential, if you have that happen, that those potatoes could have been infected with the late blight organism. Yeah. And if so, those volunteer plants are going to be infected, and that could be a very local source of that pathogen for Wisconsin's potato industry. And we have a huge potato industry here in the state. We're the third largest producer of potatoes in the U.S., worth millions and millions of dollars. And there are actually state laws that require that commercial growers destroy any leftover pieces of potatoes, coal piles, as they're called by a certain time of the year, to prevent those from being a source of this late blight organism. This is the disease that caused the Irish potato famine in the 1840s and 50s. And so my recommendation would be, if you ever see potatoes come up like that again, to dig them up and destroy them, because we really don't want to have the potential of those being a carrier of this organism. Most of the time, the late blight organism is not going to survive in Wisconsin unless we have leftover potatoes that are infected, or potentially in a compost pile. We've also worried about tomato fruits that might be infected. They also get the disease. And so if we can get rid of all of that extraneous potato and tomato material, we won't necessarily see late blight come into the state until very late in the growing season, because the spores are technically sporangia. The organism need to be blown in from out of state. So it's really a good practice, if you have any volunteer potatoes and or tomatoes, to destroy those at the beginning of the growing season as quickly as possible.
Yeah, Dave, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston, our guests today. Lisa, the horticulture educator for Dane County. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at the garden season for 2024 with our guests today, Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson, and certainly answering your questions. And our lines are filling here very quickly, so we will go back to the phones and to Sherry in Townsend. Sherry, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Okay, hi. I'm actually in Hudson, Wisconsin, where my question is about.
Okay.
I have a lot of shrubs around the house and wondering how late can you prune them back?
What kind of shrubs are they?
Well, a bunch of different kinds. I'm not sure what they all are, but they come up every year and they're big, and there's hydrangeas. Hydrangeas.
Oh. Okay. Are they white, big snowball type flowers?
Yes, those are the hydrangeas that we have there. And they kind of go purple and pink at times, or bluish.
Oh, boy. Are these new plants or older plants?
Old. They're all old plants.
They're all old plants. In general, if you've got pink and blue, you're talking about hydrangea macrophylla, and those are plants that have to have the flower bud over winter in order to have it bloom the next year. I've got to say, I'm really surprised that you would be able to grow that in Hudson, your zone, what, four or something up there? In any case, I would not prune those now, or you won't get any flowers in the spring, if that's what they are. If they're, the reason I asked about new is that hydrangea arborescens, which is the smooth hydrangea, which are the Annabelle types that have the big white snowball type flowers, big round flower heads. There is a new variety now that will bloom pink. And so that really confuses things when people are not sure which one they have. And with hydrangea arborescens, because it blooms on new wood, you can cut it to the ground in the fall or in the early spring. But with hydrangea macrophylla, you can't do that, or you lose the flowers. Unfortunately, every species is different. If you prune back most spring blooming flowers or shrubs like lilacs, mock orange, at this time of year, you'll prune off the flower buds because most of those bloom on old wood. Things that bloom later in the year, like hibiscus and spirea and so on, those can be pruned in the fall or early spring. And we do at the Wisconsin Horticulture website, I just did a video on fundamentals of shrub pruning. So we do have, I believe my resource table is there that gives you guidance on the particular type of shrub and when it, and when and how, you know, what technique you should use for pruning it.
So UW Horticulture website?
Yep.
All right, Sherry, there you go. And you can join in, 800-642-1234. Let's see. John in Wisconsin Rapids has a question. Let's go there.
Hello. Yeah, I have a question about I'm bringing in a Meyer lemon.
Okay.
And it's just started to flower, and I was wondering if there was any way I could get some fruit this year, because last year it dropped all its leaves when I brought it in.
Yeah, they'll do
that.
Yeah,
but and actually we do have a promotion here. The Wisconsin Horticulture site, we will be hosting a program on growing citrus in just a couple of weeks. So you may want to check that out and either attend, or you can watch the video after. Unfortunately, you may end up with the same situation. A lot of times those sorts of things are regulated by, you know, when you go from one sort of environment to another sort of environment, the buds may decide to drop off. So I'm not sure that there's much you can do to prevent that. Typically, they're going to bloom in the spring, and you know, you harvest sometime in the summer or fall. It's possible that they will still stick around, but it's one of those tough things. And maybe Larry has some advice based on limey.
Well, limey my lime tree would always flower as soon as I brought it in.
Yeah.
It would just explode in flowers. And I would get limes in the winter when...
Oh, you did? Okay. Interesting.
Sometimes I've had 25 or 30 limes on the on limey. So, John apparently has had problems with the Meyer lemon coming in, but I don't know what else you can do. I mean, it's going to lose its leaves, and then it's going to bring back some thicker leaves or different kind of leaves that have adjusted to the the new light situation. I always use grow lights, and I had them on a pole lamp, so the grow lights would be hitting all parts of Limey, and that seemed to help a lot.
Yeah, that when we start to lose our light levels in the fall, and then we come inside and you've got, you know, possibly more light if you're using supplemental light, or you've got the same amount of light but the temperature is completely different, you can stimulate different things to happen. And because you have to bring it in, there's not, you know, much that you can do about that. But yeah, they do often drop their leaves and buds once they come inside, and then they slowly will repopulate those leaves. And like Larry said, the leaves will be different physiologically as the plant adjusts to the different temperature and light levels.
Yeah.
So you may end up with fruits, but probably the other thing is going to happen.
Thank you, John, for calling. Matt in Blue Mounds, we'll go to you next. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I had a question about, I have a catalpa tree that I planted maybe 2 years ago. My dad had planted it by seed, and then we planted it in my yard. And this summer, I noticed towards the end of the summer that it looks like powdery mildew is growing on the leaves. I wasn't sure. I thought I had read that, you know, it doesn't harm the plant, but I wasn't sure if there was something I should be trying to do to keep that from occurring.
Yeah, on most woody ornamentals, powdery mildew is pretty much a cosmetic disease. So it doesn't do a lot of damage. So I wouldn't be terribly concerned about that having occurred on your catalpa. I would just make sure that you're careful about cleaning up the leaves either this fall or early next spring before the tree re-leafs out. That won't necessarily totally take care of the problem. You can burn, bury, or hot compost that leaf material. The thing with perennials is that sometimes the powdery mildew fungi can survive in the overwintering buds. So getting rid of those old leaves won't necessarily totally take care of the problem. But again, we have a relatively dry summer in terms of, for powdery mildews, it's in terms of relative humidity. If we have low humidity summer, you won't see a lot of the powdery mildews. And actually, if we have a really rainy season, you probably won't see a lot of powdery mildew either. Powdery mildew fungi are pretty persnickety. They don't like wet leaves. They really like dry leaves, but really high humidity. In terms of where you can see significant damage due to powdery mildews, on woody ornamentals, the primary host where I see a ton of damage is on certain varieties of ninebark. So if you're trying to grow Diablo ninebark, that particular variety of ninebark, it's a red foliaged variety, you will see pretty significant powdery mildew to the point where you will get branch tip dieback, which again is very unusual for powdery mildews. And then on herbaceous plants, you can have more serious problems sometimes. On my hit list for herbaceous plants would be things like monardas and phlox plants. And if you're a vegetable grower, you're going to see it on your cucurbits, so your cucumbers, pumpkins. And to the point on any of these herbaceous hosts that I've mentioned, you can get leaf browning and loss due to the diseases. And you can control it on those particular hosts by selecting resistant varieties. Or quite frankly, again, it's not going to kill the plants. It's really a more cosmetic issue. For most people, I tell them that the best way to deal with powdery mildews in terms of management is to develop a really good ability to ignore them, because they oftentimes people get really worked up about powdery mildews, and they're much more serious disease problems that you have to worry about. The thing I would watch for on catalpa is that it is quite susceptible to verticillium wilt. That's caused by a soil-borne fungus. It infects through the roots, colonizes the water conducting tissue, and will cause branch dieback and eventual death of the tree. So that's something you could face later on in the life of the tree.
As you were talking, I was thinking about my purple coneflowers that develop powdery mildew kind of late in the season, I thought.
Yeah, that's because it got drier. Really, we got less rain, and that's actually, and we tend to have muggy weather later in our summers here in Wisconsin. So that's the perfect combination of environmental conditions to see a lot of powdery mildew.
Yeah. Rita in Green Bay will give you a chance. Hi, Rita.
Hi. I have a question. I would like to plant a perennial under a long needle pine tree. I don't know what kind it is, but it would be planted in total shade where it is wet in the spring. I have hostas that I call plantain lilies that thrive on the sunny side of this tree. And I'm wondering what I could plant behind the tree.
Well, it's wet.
The hostas don't do well there?
I'm sorry, what?
So you've tried the hostas in that other area? Hostas.
No, I haven't. Would that be an idea I could do?
Yeah, I would try that. It's hard with evergreens because not only do you have the pretty dense shade, but sometimes it's pretty dry underneath those plants. So it can be a challenging environment for plants. I have had good luck growing hostas under spruces. Also, reasonably good luck with if you're looking for a native, Canada wild ginger. But yeah, it's a tough area. And if the hostas are surviving on the one side, my guess is they do okay on the other side.
I was thinking about ferns because we are going to be talking about ferns in the last 30 minutes of the show today, but it's so dry. I don't know. There aren't many ferns that like dry. They like wet. But they're perfect for, a lot of shade.
Right.
Yeah. Right. There you go, Rita. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston are guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Taking a look at your garden today on Garden Talk and sort of reviewing the 2024 gardening season. We're talking everything from disease to just standard growing issues that might have developed with our two guests, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, who directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. Questions? Open lines will get you on fairly quickly. The number is 800-642-1234, or you can email to talk@wpr.org. I know if you guys have had a chance to look at the email from Dale in Oconomowoc, had a couple of redbud trees next, and one is losing its bark from the ground up to the branches. Looks like it was struck by lightning and the bark exploded, but there was no lightning. The other red bud is not as much direct sunlight and it's holding the bark just fine. Trees are a good 20 feet tall and the same basic age, but the one's got this bark leaving.
Yeah, it looks like a frost crack to me on the tree. And also the other thing that struck me as I looked at that photo was looked like the tree might have been planted a little bit too deeply. The trunk goes kind of into the ground like a telephone pole. So there's no flare at the bottom of that trunk, which is what we normally want when the tree is planted. And so when you plant the tree too deeply, that tends to put the trees under a bit of stress. And then as the bark tends to cycle through periods of heating and cooling during the wintertime, that can put additional stress on the bark that'll lead to a crack. And then those can expand from there. Sometimes it's just the physical injury and you from that heating and thawing. Sometimes you can get fungi that will invade through those cracks and will cause additional damage. I don't see any evidence in the photos that there are fungal infections, but that's certainly something that can happen. Unfortunately, not much you can do about that once those cracks occur, other than just kind of optimize the fertility and watering of the tree. And I wouldn't necessarily go out there and just fertilize. I would get a soil test done and double check to see what nutrients the tree needs and then fertilize accordingly. But definitely for watering, there's a lot of grass around that tree as well. I would remove the grass out at least 3 feet from the trunk. And I usually advocate all the way out to the drip line, quite frankly, but most people don't want to do that. That would be out to the edge of where the branches extend, and then mulch that area with a high quality mulch on 1 to 2 inches. If you have kind of a more clay soil, a heavier soil, maybe 3 inches if you have a lighter, sandier soil. Keep that mulch away from the trunk, about 4 to 6 inches, so you don't trap moisture around the bark. That can be bad news. That can promote infections as well. And correct me, Lisa, if I'm giving any inappropriate information here.
Yeah, I concur. And looking at that, it definitely looks like it was planted too deep. I don't see any evidence of a root flare.
Unless the grass is hiding it, but it doesn't look like it.
Yeah, that could be.
The other thing I would look for, although I don't see them that often on redbuds, but certainly if I had a similar situation in a maple, I would look for girdling roots. And those are roots that will, instead of growing outward from the trunk, grow around the trunk. And then as the tree gets bigger and bigger, eventually the trunk will come into contact with those roots. And that will constrict the water conducting tissue and limit water movement up the tree. And that can stress, again, the bark enough to contribute to these frost cracks forming. And there's, I have to say, I have seen so many examples, particularly since I've started to do more digital diagnostics, since we had COVID and I had to rely on photos to be able to provide service to people, seeing a lot of situations where trees have been improperly planted over the years. And I think that's a big issue. So make sure if you are putting in a tree that you, again, have what's called the root flare exposed at the soil surface. So that's the part of the trunk that widens to form the root system. If you're buying bald and burlap material, our recommendation is to remove the burlap, remove the wire basket that is underneath that burlap that kind of stabilizes the root ball. And definitely please take off any strings or cords or anything that's attaching that burlap to the trunk. Can't tell you how many situations I've seen where people have left on, particularly nylon cords that do not rot. And even jute doesn't necessarily rot that quickly. And if you leave those on, you can actually girdle the trees with those cords.
Yeah. And it usually takes a while. So you kind of forgotten 5 years down the road.
Yeah. It doesn't always happen, you know, right away. And the tree gets about the size that you're explaining, the, you know, 20 feet. And it's really sad to lose a tree at that age.
Jeanette in Woodville has a question. Hi, Jeanette.
Well, hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, it's on my mind and it's on my lawn because I did live on the dairy farm, and 20 years ago I did have a flowering crab moved in, so that's got to be 20 years in here, and I have so many invasive little trees, and it's on my front lawn. And because we're in a twin home, I don't think the other people like all these little trees. So is there anything? When I read about it, it said they're gifts from God and just cut them off.
Well, that's what I do on my sister's lawn. I just, she's got the same problem, and I just mow them over when I'm mowing the lawn. And I don't know what else you can do.
Other than remove the tree and, you know, plant one that doesn't, there is one, let's see if I can remember, I think it was called Spring Snow, that was a crab that doesn't produce too many fruits. But since the plant grew from a seed, you can pretty much be sure that it's going to continue to propagate itself in that way. So unfortunately, the mowing is probably the most easy way to get rid of it.
Yeah. There you go, Jeanette. Garrett in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, Larry. Love your show.
Thank you.
Big help. But I need some saving grace here. I have an avocado tree that is now 8 foot tall and a lemon tree that's 9 foot tall growing in my house. They have outgrown their pots. I need to replant them, and I'm just trying to figure out what I can use for soil.
Okay. I got this one. So for citrus, there are citrus mixes that have fair amount of bark in them, actually. For citrus, you generally want something that drains well, and I'm sure Larry could, but you had to repot limey, so yeah. I'll let you talk about that. If these plants are getting too tall, you can prune them. It would be ideal to do that, though, in the spring as opposed to this time of year. It's also best to do repotting in the spring as well. If you can possibly wait until that point, that would be better for the plant when we start to get, you know, new growth, because there's more light and so on, that they're more easily adapting to that. When you do repot, we usually recommend for house plants that you don't go any bigger than two, or since you've got more or less trees, 3 inches, I'd say bigger in diameter than the current pot. And the reason for that is because you don't want the soil to stay too wet. I don't think there is any particular type of, you know, a specialty type of potting soil that avocado needs. So I think you can just use regular potting soil for that. But the citrus, definitely there is a citrus type of mix.
Yeah, and it works pretty well, too. And you're right about the potting size, too. You don't want to go way bigger. That's not a good thing to do.
Yeah, you tend to end up with overly saturated soils that don't dry out, and then you increase the risk for, from my perspective, root rot issues. And definitely do not bring in garden soil to repot these plants. That's absolutely a bad thing to do. You're going to bring in root rot pathogens with that soil, and given that most people tend to overwater houseplants anyway, you're asking for issues with root rots.
Garrett, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Al in Green Bay, have you got a quick question for us?
Hi, yes. I have 4 large lilacs that sort of got away from me. And in the past, I would trim out about a third of them. And now it's beyond that. I'm wondering if I just can cut them all the way down. I'm not worried about flowering like next year. Is it possible just to, you know, cut them completely, all the big stuff out?
There is a pruning technique that's called rejuvenation pruning. It is a very severe form of pruning. There aren't a whole lot of plants that we recommend that for. If these are plants that are in good health, however, you can prune lilac fairly severely, but you need to do it during the dormant season. So ideally, you know, as long as they didn't like lose their leaves this year, you noticed a lot of dieback, or they seem unhealthy. If that's the case, then I wouldn't use that technique, but you can do that on lilacs. The idea when you do that is that you're recreating the architecture of the plant. You're going to get a whole bunch of sprouts, and what you'll need to do is choose the ones that are the strongest. You know, you don't want to necessarily create a thicket, but you want to instead recreate that architecture. So I do that in March, probably.
Yeah, probably a good time. Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston will be with us right up until 12:30, and we will take your calls and questions and through that time. Right now, we're going to take a quick look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News and Garden Talk, and we'll be back right after the news. You're listening to Garden Talk on the News Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson are back with us. Brian's the director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. And Lisa, Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. We have lots of questions. We got callers. We got emails. Adam emailed. He has two apple trees about 25 feet apart. As far as he can tell, he has removed every nearby cedar and juniper, but one of the two apple trees continues to get rust while the other seems unaffected. He doesn't remember the varieties of each tree, but are some more inclined while others are immune? Also, while all cedar within proximity have been removed, there's one about 200 yards away, but it is downwind. Could that be the source of the rust?
Yeah, there are differences in terms of varieties and in terms of severity of cedar apple rust. This particular disease is one where the fungus spends part of its life cycle on things like apple trees and then another part of its life cycle on junipers. And red cedar is a type of juniper. Interestingly, you know, although we recommend removing junipers anywhere close to your apples or crab apples, unfortunately, if you look at recommendations for commercial orchards, the recommendation on how far away from apple trees it is to remove junipers is 2 to 3 miles. So that's not something you're likely going to accomplish in a kind of a home setting. So just be aware that it is a good thing to remove those junipers that are close to your trees, but that may not totally take care of the problem. The upside to the gymnosporangium rusts in general is that they tend to be pretty cosmetic diseases, particularly if you're seeing the ones where you get the kind of yellowish spots on the leaves. This typically don't cause a lot of severe damage. There is a variation on these rusts. It's called cedar quince rust, where you potentially can get twig infections and might cause a little bit of twig dieback. Most commonly, I see that causing a problem on Crotegus on hawthorns. And also that's the one where if you've ever had a hawthorn get really spiny, kind of salmon-y colored fruits, that's that particular disease. And then one other thing I will mention in the context of these rusts, if you ever on a crab apple or an apple tree start to see what looks like cedar apple rust, which typically has yellow or orange spots, but the spots that you're seeing are really red or kind of a fuchsia color, give me a shout because we do have a new variant of this disease. It's called red star rust, and it's a recent discovery here in the state. We're trying to map that county by county. So if you see those particular symptoms, feel free to give me a shout. You can go to my clinic website, which is pddc.wisc.edu. My contact information is there. You can send me some photographs if I think it's this new rust. If you're from a county where we don't have a confirmed case, I'll ask you to send in a sample so we can try to confirm. And we do all of that free of charge. So there's really no cost to you other than to mail the sample to me.
As long as we're talking about colors, Lana and Tom in Stone Lake emailed that they had orange dust on their shoes while walking on their lawn this fall. What's that?
Yeah, that's most likely what's called crown rust. And again, it's another one of these alternating rusts. We talked about bean rust earlier in the show. That particular rust fungus completes its life cycle on a single type of plant. So it will complete its entire life cycle on beans. But there are a variety of different types of rust fungi that require two different hosts. So we just talked about cedar apple rust, which alternates between apples and crab apples and junipers. And then this crown rust, which you're seeing on your turf, that alternates between turf grass and, of all things, buckthorn. So if you need another reason to really hate buckthorn, if you don't hate it already, that's another reason. So if you can remove the buckthorn in the vicinity of your turf grass, you can get rid of that particular disease.
Lori in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I grew up on a farm. I'm 61 now, and I grew up on a farm in Rock County. Earlier, you were talking about potatoes, and might be my childhood recollection, but lots of things went to reseed. And I was wondering, you were saying potatoes are one of those that you don't do, like, let them reseed. It isn't my memory that was unsuccessful. Sometimes it was so overgrown, you know, we'd eat as much as we could, we'd share with neighbors, but it sometimes just was the last thing we could manage. And so I was wondering if you could speak to a couple of the things, specifically potatoes, but others that are okay that they reseed themselves. And then lastly, a couple of days ago, I think there was a call about small farms in Wisconsin, and we were talking about the regulations of potatoes. And it's like, well, it kind of goes contrary to, you know, people having small farms, and I'm not saying unregulate, but, you know, not overregulate people trying to raise a garden.
Mm.
Yeah. Again, what the disease I was specifically talking about is late blight. And potatoes, really, typically, you're not going to see them reseed, so produce a lot of seeds per se. But typically, what we're worried about is leftover tubers that you might not have harvested that might somehow survive the winter. And if your potato patch was potentially infected with this late blight organism, that organism could potentially survive in the tubers. And if those survive over the winter, then if those tubers sprout, then that pathogen is going to kind of move up that sprouting plant, and it's going to start to sporulate in those plants. And then you have a very, what we call, local source of the pathogen. So one that's directly in the state, close to, again, our important potato industry here in Wisconsin. So that's the reason why we recommend, if you see any evidence of volunteer potatoes coming up, and I would also suggest if you see volunteer tomatoes coming up, those would be situations where our recommendation would be to remove those plants. And what you can do is just kind of dig them up, stick them in. If you're dealing with a small garden, would be to dig them up, stick them in a couple of garbage bags, black garbage bags, and then just stick those out in the sun and let them cook. And that will kill off the plants and will also kill off the pathogen. And then you can stick those bagged up plants. I would put them in your garbage. I would not put them into a compost pile, but stick them in your garbage and get rid of them that way.
And the tomatoes, it's the discarded fruits or fallen fruits that it does come back from seed, as opposed to the potatoes, where it's actually the tubers. And not the seeds. And, you know, sometimes you miss a few when you're digging them up, or occasionally a rodent finds them and carries them off somewhere. And the same thing can happen, you know, with the tomatoes. And certainly I've seen my share of compost pile tomatoes and squash and potatoes.
Yeah. Lori, thank you for calling. John in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, John.
Yes, thank you. Question, we planted a new serviceberry tree just in the spring, and it's probably 8 foot tall, and the trunk is like between an inch and a half in diameter. Well, wouldn't you know it, a few days ago, a buck must have come along and rubbed the bark off between a third and a halfway around that little trunk. And probably, you know, a foot high in terms of the rubbed off bark. So my question is that tree going to survive, or is that a goner?
Oh, that's my condolences. I hate it when that happens. I take it this is a single trunk tree?
Yes, it's a single trunk.
Oh, darn. It may come back from the base. You may get from the rootstock. And I don't know whether it's a grafted service berry or whether it's a straight species. If it's a named plant, then it's probably grafted onto a straight species of amelanchier, in which case you might end up with a different looking plant, and in fact, a different potential species. if it came back that way. But usually if it's a third or a half girdled around the base, it's not going to probably make it. That's a big wound. And I've had that happen too, and it's absolutely heartbreaking. So what I would recommend, if you're in an area where you do get deer, is to put hardware cloth around the base of those trees. You don't want it so tight that you're, you know, going to girdle the tree. But if you can get it, you know, 36, 48 inches up, that often will be in their kind of preferred buck rubbing territory, and so they would leave it alone. If you want to try to see if the tree will come back, you know, send up a sucker, and it very well may leaf out in spring, or it may bud out and then die, or it may get through part of the year, and then when it starts to get hot and dry, not make it because of the vascular damage. You know, if you do want to try that, I would make sure to go ahead and fence it. But I got to say, I don't have a whole lot of
hope for it. There you go, John. Stephanie in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there. I have three Sun King Aurelias that I have planted underneath the moderate shade of a Black Hill spruce that's had probably the bottom 4 feet of limbs taken off.
Okay.
And I would say I planted them about 6 years ago. The first couple years, they did great. These last few years, they come up looking good. And then I would say by early August, I start to see leaves turn yellow and then to light brown and die. By the early September or so, I'm cutting off most of the plant because most of it's dead. But it comes back the next year looking good again. Thoughts?
Does the plant look as though it's, when it resprouts the next spring, is it getting to fairly good size, or does it look as though it's stunted at all?
I would say decent size, maybe not as big as what the directions or, you know, the guidance says it could be, up to 3 feet by 3 feet, but not far off from that.
Okay. I'm wondering if it has a kind of a low level of a root infection of some kind. So the root rot pathogens could potentially come in, kind of kill off a few of the smaller fine roots, which will inhibit nutrient and water uptake, and then as you get into kind of the drier periods in the summer, that might lead to the yellowing and then browning of the foliage, but not severe enough infections to totally kill the plants. That's just my first guess from a disease standpoint.
Yeah,
it seems like root rot would be less likely under a spruce.
Depends on the rain pattern. And again, yeah, if we get periods where it's been really wet, like we had this spring where there was substantial water in the soil, that could potentially set you up for this sort of situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm curious about this because I've heard this. This is the second time that I've heard something like this. Brian, you may remember Mr. Esser's plant a few years ago. But we thought that might be verticillium.
I wouldn't expect the plant to resprout if it tends to kill the plants.
But I have the same plant, and it's about 4 feet by 4 feet. It just gets enormous every year. So yeah, I agree with Brian that it's got to be something that's stunting it. A root pathogen is probably the most likely answer.
Yeah. Stephanie,
but it's getting all three of them. Yeah. That's unfortunate.
Very unfortunate. Stephanie.
And again, if you want to try to see whether that's really what's going on, you'd be welcome to submit a sample to my clinic. We do tests for root rot pathogens. Again, if you go to my clinic website, there's information there about how to submit a sample. If you need guidance, just shoot me an email and I can provide you with directions on what and how to submit, or we can talk more about this, you know, off the air. But that's about the only thing I can think of that give that sort of pattern of dieback, at least from my perspective.
Stephanie, there you go. Thank you for calling. Vivian in Door County, we'll go to you. Hi, Vivian. Vivian, are you there? Vivian was wondering if you can wrap, we were talking about tree deer damage. Can you wrap trees as opposed to putting hardware cloth around them?
It's not usually a good idea, and I'll let Brian expound on this further if he wants to, because it can stay too wet in there, you can end up with rot problems. Also, anytime you have anything tightly wrapped around a tree, you can end up girdling it over time. With the hardware cloth, you get good air circulation.
That makes a lot of sense. Beth in Cottage Grove emailed a photo of diseased leaves on her linden tree, and I don't know if you had a chance to look at that.
Yeah, it's not a disease, actually. That's spindle galls on linden, if we're talking about the same.
That's
same
what
one.
It is.
Yeah, so those are a result of a little tiny microscopic mite called an aerified mite. And there are hundreds of different species. A lot of them are kind of host specific. So they cause different kinds of galls, shapes of galls, colors of galls on different plants. On maples, sometimes you do see what's called velvet gall or erinium gall, which is bright pink and velvety, instead of like on the linden, we have the kind of upright. They're also called nail galls. It isn't anything to worry about. Some years you'll see more of it, and some years you'll see less of it. It's not anything that you need to treat either. More of a kind of a curiosity, an interesting thing, a response to either feeding or egg laying that a plant will respond by creating a specific color, shape, and size of growth around the either feeding or the egg.
Sharon in Menominee called to ask when she can prune her autumn Jubilee nine bark and also forsythia to invigorate them.
Okay, so the forsythia should be pruned after it blooms, right after it blooms in spring. You want to do it usually within a couple of weeks of the end of flowering, because they do start to initiate new flower buds. Now, some plants take longer to do it and you have a bigger window, and others don't. So I just usually tell people between 2 and 3 weeks after it finishes flowering. The nine bark, and Brian can talk about this, is a plant that you probably should do a lot of pruning on, because it is very susceptible to powdery mildew, and it gets these, you probably have seen them, kind of blighted twigs where they're sort of powdery looking and gnarly and stunted. You want to do your pruning during the dormant season. And with nine bark, it's nice because of the colors. You know, if you have a brightly colored one like you do, the new growth is the most colorful, unfortunately, probably also the most susceptible to powdery mildew. But keeping good air circulation is a really good thing to do with those nine barks. So pruning out about a third of the biggest, oldest branches at the base, Some people do use that fairly severe rejuvenation pruning to get rid of as much of the mildew as possible. So you can do that on healthy younger plants as well. I wouldn't advocate doing it every spring, but maybe every other spring. And again, it needs to be done during the dormant season. Brian, I don't know if you want to add anything about.
No, the only thing I would mention is that where I've really seen severe powdery mildew on ninebark is really specifically the variety Diablo, and in general on the red foliage varieties rather than the green foliage varieties.
All right. D in Mineral Point called to say he has a new lilac, small lilac tree. Does she need to protect it this winter? It's in the ground. Does it need protecting?
I would say any young tree, particularly fruit trees, because they seem to be particularly tasty to rabbits, but and voles. But you know, if you have deer pressure, a smaller tree, they seem to like those ones that are like between 1 and 2 inch diameter. And it's just a good idea for younger trees to be protected over the winter. And you can get that hardware cloth in different heights. I usually recommend about 36 inches if it'll fit under the first tier of branches. And you can use landscape staples. They're also called sod staples to kind of anchor it into the ground. I often will also put some like bark around it to hold it in place. And you can close the cylinder with anything from twist ties to small zip ties, you know, twisties if you want to reuse it, and zip ties if you don't mind getting rid of that material. And I would do that sometime, if not this month, do it next month for sure.
Yeah. And when you say hardware cloth, people have asked me about this, and I said, well, it's kind of like a screen, you know, the screen on your porch.
Right. I like to use that as opposed to chicken wire, because voles and, you know, can easily, and other rodents can easily get through that chicken wire. But the hardware cloth comes in half inch grid or half inch mesh and a quarter inch. So you're not going to have things getting through that. And it's just like a really stiff screen that comes in a roll. It is very pokey. I would use thick gloves when you handle it and a tin snips to cut it with.
Yep. And finally, Dean, just a quick mention. Dean says for the horse chestnut tree, he advises listeners to let the squirrels do the planting. They do a great job in his yard. And on that happy note, Lisa and Brian, thank you both so much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry.
Lisa,
thank you, Larry.
Yeah, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County, and Brian Huddleston, Director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic in the Department of Plant Pathology at UW-Madison. They'll be back. Coming up, we're going to take a look, a really interesting look, I think, at ferns. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Ferns have been around for millions of years and are among the oldest plants on Earth, as a matter of fact. And next up, we talk with fern expert Moby Weinstein. We'll talk about the history of these well-loved plants. We look at their basic botany and how to care for them. And it's great to have Moby with us. She's foreman of Gardeners for Outdoor... I should say foreman of Gardeners for Outdoor Gardeners at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. She's a lecturer, a plant judge, and an author of two books on ferns. I have in front of me her book titled The Complete Book of Ferns. And I have really enjoyed going through this book. It's fascinating. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. We often get questions about ferns. And if you have one about growing them inside or out, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Moby Weinstein, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you.
So what is it about ferns that has drawn you to them?
Well, I didn't choose them per se at the very beginning. I just love all plants. And very early on in my career at the Botanical Garden in New York, I was assigned to take care of the ferns. So I said, well, if I'm going to take care of them, I need to know a little bit about them. And was very fortunate that we had scientists on our staff that were world authorities on ferns. We had meetings every month of the New York chapter of the American Fern Society. And so immediately I got engrossed in them and then, of course, fell in love with them even more.
Well, you know, we see ferns in every dinosaur movie.
Exactly.
Give us a little of the history of ferns. When do we think they first appeared on Earth?
Well, the first land plants really came on about 450 million years ago or so. You know, it's quite a long time ago. Well, first plants, let's say that, not land plants so much. And then the ferns were the first to become what we call vascular, making a specialized tissue that allowed them to kind of move out of the water and onto the land. And so they precede all of our seed-producing plants, because they came on the scene probably about 350 million years ago. And they were probably from the ancient ferns that don't make seed but make spore. They're, we know from the fossil records that there are some plants we call seed ferns that were probably that transition, that we don't have any of those alive today, but probably were the transition to our modern-day seed plants. So they've been around for a really, really long time, colonizing great parts of the planet and giving us our coal deposits that we've been using and using and using from buried giant forests of the ancient ferns, the lycophytes, that were 100 or 150 feet tall and that got buried during, you know, continents colliding and all kinds of massive changes on our planet. And those deep buried reserves are what we use now as coal.
Yeah, very interesting. And, you know, they're unique, I think, in the plant world because, as you were talking about, they produce not by flowers or seeds, but via spores.
Yes. So the first plants were the algae in the water, and then the what we call the mosses, which most people have heard of, and things like liverworts, which maybe people haven't heard of. These were just very low, flat, filmy plants that kind of hugged the water surface. They kind of moved out of water, but they had to be in contact with water all the time, basically. And it was really from them, they reproduced by spore. From then, we kind of got the ferns, who also reproduced by spore. But what they did, which was an enormous change, which hasn't really been changed since then, is they developed what we call a vascular system. It's like not the same, obviously, as what we have in humans or animals, a vein and artery system, a system that conducts water and nutrients and the sugars that it makes in photosynthesis through the plant body. So it's like our blood moving through our body. It's their stuff moving through their bodies to keep them alive. And that's what enabled them to get away from the water, to be able to put roots down into the soil and take water out and to be able to get taller and bigger and stronger. And that system, that vascular system, is really important. And we don't have anything more advanced than that today. So they have one step in the what we call the ancient world, their ancestral world, reproducing by spore, and they have the one foot in the modern world, the evolved world, with their vascular system. So they are unique in having that. It's a very distinct difference.
And they were used, they were used differently, or they've been used by humans over the years in different ways, I guess. How did humans use ferns in the past?
Well, they've always been used as ornaments. Many of them are just really attractive, and something in them calls to us because it's very typical that when people see certain types of ferns, particularly things like the maidenhairs, people are drawn to them. People are drawn to plants. We know this, and research has proven this now. We are naturally drawn to nature and to plants, and our blood pressure goes down when we get into the forest mm-hmm. and things like this. So we know we respond to this. But ferns have a lot of them, with their textures and their forms, have just really drawn people to them. And in the mid-1800s, which is not so long ago, we had, well, in Europe, they had the Victorian fern craze. And what really led to that was the fact that Dr. Ward had invented the Wardian case. He was an amateur science person, and he was collecting ferns. And in Europe, with the burning of coal, there was so much pollution and the air was dry that he developed this little case, and he kept his plants alive in that. And so it's called the Wardian case after him. And that made a great change for people to be able to grow things they couldn't grow indoors. And it was a big craze. And they went all over England, particularly, unfortunately, collecting so much that they really overcollected and endangered many plants. It was such a craze. But we're able to keep them alive in their parlors, in their homes, and it was exciting to show people what they had. And the forms, you can also see how beautiful the forms of ferns are, because you see them in benches, you see them in signs, you see them in pictures. Every time you look at a catalog, even for furniture, you'll see a picture of a couch in a living room setting, and what's on the wall is a print of a fern leaf. So you see them everywhere because they do have great forms, and they're attractive to us as plants are, but ferns seem to be a little more so. And so you see them everywhere. So people have been using them. We don't eat too much of them, but we do eat fiddleheads. And depending on where you are in the world, people eat different species. Probably you have it in Wisconsin as well, but certainly in the Northeast here, the one we usually eat are the fiddlehead ferns, the ostrich ferns, the fiddleheads of the ostrich fern, one of our natives. And so we eat those, but they're also eaten in other parts of the world. There is one, though, that has been eaten, and we do know that it probably is somewhat carcinogenic, and so we wouldn't recommend that one. That's bracken fern, which is really a joke in the fern world that we say there's only one bracken plant in the world, and it's connected across the entire world. It is a massive plant that just spreads, and that's why we joke it spreads so much. We think it's just one continuous plant. So it's a great plant, but we think that we know that that one you probably shouldn't eat so much of.
Penny in Winona, Minnesota has a comment or a question. Let's go there. Penny,
sure.
Hi.
Yeah, hi. I probably missed it when I was talking to the person who answered, but I had the ferns at my house in New Jersey. So hello, Doctor, from my native New Yorker. And I just have a question, because the ones that you can eat, are they the ostrich ferns that you can eat, the little
fiddleheads?
Yes, the fiddleheads. Thank you. It was blanking.
Yes.
I got those growing in my garden in New Jersey, and they became very invasive. I loved them, but they really went crazy. Now, I was interested in putting them
by where I had some evergreens on the border of my property here in Minnesota. And is that, do you know if that's something that I should have a problem with being like invasive to Minnesota? They do have room where I want to put them to kind of go free.
Right. So we wouldn't technically call it invasive because it would be native for you. And just so you know, if a plant is very aggressive, but it's native, then it's naturally evolved in that habitat, and we don't call it invasive. But yes, as you have learned from experience, it does spread. And in areas where you want that great covering, that's fantastic. If you have a very limited space, you will kind of always be pulling it out. I have grown it in containers in spaces where I didn't want it to colonize. So it would probably act much the same for you as it did in New Jersey. And so that's really for you to choose. But if you pull it up every year, like if every year you do a little, you would maintain it. If you let it get out of control, that's when it's going to start taking hold, and it will be a bigger job for you to dig out.
Yeah, I
hope that helps.
I think that makes a lot of sense. Benny, thanks a lot for calling. You can join in, two numbers, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest, Moby Weinstein. Her book is The Complete Book of Ferns. That's one of her books, anyway. It's a dandy book on ferns, and it's fun talking with her about them. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Thanks so much for joining in today on Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here visiting with Moby Weinstein, foreman of gardeners for outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden, and her book is that I've had a chance to look at it, really love. It's called titled The Complete Book of Ferns. And questions, again, join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. You know, when I think about ferns, sort of like a Boston fern comes to mind. The lace of the leaves, and really quite beautiful. But ferns, I mean, you look at a tongue fern, for example. Now, that doesn't look like a fern.
Exactly. It's something that people do. When I ask people what makes a plant a fern, of course, most people don't know, but they think, oh, it has very lacy, delicate leaves. Yeah. And many of them do, but many of them do not. And you would look at that plant and not guess at all that it's a fern. Unless you started to know something about, oh, they make spores, and you happen to look and you might recognize that it's making spores on the back of the leaf. But they are so really diverse. There's about 12,000 species, really worldwide, except for Antarctica, where apparently in the fossil record it shows they were there at one point, but not now. And so some are very large, very coarse, and some are very fine, and there's shades of light green to dark green and even bluish, or, you know, like a grayish color. And then you have the painted fern, which is a very common one for outdoors, which has silver and often red in it. So they're really quite diverse, and people don't always recognize one if it's not a more common one that they've seen.
Yeah. And, you know, you take one like the ribbon fern, for example, where you've got sort of a green edge along the outside of the leaf, and then a very, very light green center to it.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
And white and silver, yeah. And their forms, between their forms and their colors and even their textures, they can be a very thick, leathery texture, which often tells you they might do better without some humidity. Because the ones that are very thin and delicate usually need more humidity. But they do give great, you know, not only their form, but their texture and their colors. And if you can mix, and there's plenty for indoors that, if you're an indoor grower, those, or if you're in a tropical climate, you can do them outdoors. But you guys are not tropical, as we are not in New York.
That's for sure. Oh, boy. Well, you know, you think about ferns in humid settings.
Right.
Do we need to create that indoors?
Well, here we go again. This is where most of our homes do not have good humidity. And so, number one, it's better for us if the humidity is higher, especially in wintertime. It's better for our health as well as the plants. But if you can't humidify, there are some ferns that are really well adapted. And the one you named, the ribbon fern, is one of the terrace ferns. Those are generally pretty good for growing indoors. They don't need a lot of attention. And some of the bird's nest ferns, and one of the, we don't necessarily call it the Boston fern, but it's a very close relative. We call it the sword fern, and it basically looks the same, but it's a different species. And that is really tough for indoors. So I have an apartment in New York City, and I live with the same problems that a lot of indoor people have. High heat and dry air. And so these are ones that they do not get babied. They survive. They're good growers. The maidenhairs are the opposite. They tend to have very delicate leaves. And if they don't have enough humidity, they will just fry on you. And a point to make about humidity that I find a lot of people maybe don't understand or just out of desperation might try. Watering the soil doesn't make up for humidity in the air. So if your air is so dry, you can't keep watering the plant to make up for it. You wind up just rotting it. So grouping your plants together helps. Of course, having a humidifier will help greatly. And also, if you're trying to increase the humidity, put them on little trays or saucers where you have water in the tray so it can evaporate and cool and humidify the air. Just make sure the base of the pot or container is not sitting in the water. Usually you put pebbles or marbles or something like that to keep it above the water so it doesn't keep the soil wet, but it keeps the air more humid. You'd be amazed how quickly that evaporates. You could be filling it every day, and that's how you realize, wow, the air is really dry.
Bev in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bev.
Sure. I'm wondering if you are familiar with the black rabbit's foot fern. Uh-huh. I have one. It's beautiful, easy to take care of, but it has a very unusual, I guess it's a root that gets all fuzzy and grows all over the place underneath, around the pot.
Right. So that's not actually the root. Everyone thinks it is because it's not typical for us to see that. It's actually the stem that you see, and the stem is covered in those are Davallias, and that group is kind of known for having these long creeping rhizomes, we call them. It's a modified stem, and they're covered with hairs, which is why often they look like a rabbit's foot, and some have a whiter scales and hairs. They're really more scales, and some have more brown, and some have almost more black, and they can be slender or very thick. It all depends on the species. But they normally don't grow in the soil. They like to grow on rocks or on other trees or plants. And then they have just small root systems that kind of cling on to those things. But it makes them very attractive for us. If you're ever repotting it and they're growing outside, that means they're happy. Don't take them and stick them into the soil because that will rot them because they're used to being out in the air. And luckily, they are pretty tolerant of drier conditions, so they make a good houseplant for us. But they also have a very handsome leaf. But their little creeping stems like that are very curious. And people are like, this is fun. What's this? And then you can pet them. You don't have a cat or a dog to pet.
Oh, Bev, thanks a lot for calling. By the way, Mary emailed back to the ostrich ferns for a minute. She said, yes, ostrich ferns take over in central Wisconsin, just like in New York. She says she's speaking from experience.
Yes, and I know that feeling.
Oh, man. You know, probably the most, perhaps the strangest fern that I noted in your book was the squirrel's foot fern, which I would never guess was a fern.
It
does look almost like a squirrel's tail to me, but tell us about the squirrel's foot fern.
Yeah, that's also one of the dahlias, right? So that picture in the book that you can see, other people probably can't, is exactly what Bev, I think I got her name right, was just asking about, her dahlia, her rabbit's foot. So they're called rabbit's foot, squirrel's foot, it depends on it. But it's really the stem, and they're just covered with these scales. And that helps to protect them a little because they are sitting out there exposed. But what they'll do if you grow them in a basket, if it's a plastic basket, they don't really adhere to it. But if it's clay and it's porous, they'll often kind of stick to it a little. And especially if it's a moss basket, then they will definitely grow around the outside, and you will see all of that kind of fuzzy stem around the bottom and then the green leaves on top. But it's not something you want to camouflage. It's actually something you want to see. It's part of the interesting part of the plant.
Oh, definitely, definitely is. So what are the varieties you most recommend for growing inside?
For inside, I would recommend the bird's nest fern, particularly the Japanese one, which is botanically Asplenium antiquum. I find that to be, and not just myself, but if you read about it, probably other people will say as well, that one of the species is probably the easiest indoors, and it's a little smaller, although keeping it in small pots will prevent it from getting 2 feet long each leaf. I have them, as I said, in small pots in my apartment, and they're not bigger than, 12 inches across the entire plant. That's because it's in a small pot. If I keep potting it up and potting up, I could get it to be 2 to 4 feet across, but that would be too big for me. But in our greenhouses, at the Botanical Garden, we do have them that large, but they stay a little smaller, but they just tolerate indoors beautifully. And there are some very cool varieties of it. They tend to, what we say, fork at the tips, so they get crested and their tips get all funny looking and people love them, or the edges get ruffled. So there are also some nice varieties of those. The brake ferns or the terrace ferns are also give us some good coloring, as you were mentioning, and are easy. The dahlias, the squirrel's foot, rabbit's foot, hare's foot, those are great. The Japanese holly fern is a good indoor fern as well. Might be hardy for some people, depending on where they live, but not for your climate and our climate. Those are some of my favorites of them. And also the sword fern that I mentioned, the Nephrolepis cordifolia, is a wonderful one for indoors.
That's a really cool plant. I like those leaves.
Yeah.
Well, your book, here we're running out of time, but I did want to mention the back part of your book where you have talking about terrariums and creating them and pressed fern art are just absolutely fabulous. And
thank you.
The artwork is great, and I love the cover, the complete book of ferns. And Moby, it's been a pleasure. Would you come back and be with us again? Love to have you back.
I would love to. Absolutely. Anytime.
Moby Weinstein.
It's nice to speak to other people.
And we'll have more people for you to talk with next time around. Moby Weinstein.
Great.
She is the foreman of... Yes, thank you for being with us. She's the foreman of gardeners for outdoor gardens at the New York Botanical Garden in the Bronx. And her book is one of the two books, but the book I have in front of me is The Complete Book of Ferns. Fantastic book. Well, we have a fantastic group of people to work on this program. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. We've got technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins with me today. And our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. Monday, Jesse LeGrew is back to take your IT and tech questions. But in the meantime, Thank you so much for listening, and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.